The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Catholic News Agency, Religion News Service, and the Christian Century. The first article is from Catholic News, published on December 10, and written by Madeleine El Habel. Papal Foundation announces $800,000 of scholarship awards to 110 religious and lay people. The Papal Foundation, a U.S.-based organization that provides funding for Catholic projects around the world, recently announced that it has awarded $800,000 to recipients of its scholarship fund. The awards were distributed across 42 countries and helped enable 110 priests, brothers, sisters, and laypeople to pursue their studies at 14 pontifical universities in Rome as participants in the foundation's St. John Paul II scholarship program. Since its founding, the program has provided nearly $14 million in scholarships to more than 1,700 individuals, known as Seamen Scholars, to advance their education and prepare them to return home and serve in leadership positions in their own countries, the foundation stated. Eustace Mita, president of the Papal Foundation's Board of Trustees, in the release invoked the foundation's establishment at the request of Pope John Paul II. "We are inspired by and committed to St. John Paul II's vision to prepare Catholic leaders and educators for service," she said. "These scholarships help train those called to lead in developing nations where resources for ongoing leadership formation are limited." December 5 marked 25 years since the foundation launched its John Paul II Scholarship Fund after John and Carol Seamen, a couple from Denver, made a gift of $5 million that was matched by the Papal Foundation. The Papal Foundation is the only charitable organization in the U.S. that is exclusively dedicated to fulfilling the requests of the Holy Father for the needs of the Church, and has dedicated more than $225 million to causes designated by popes since its inception. The foundation receives its funding from personal money donated by its stewards of St. Peter, while the Holy Father designates the use of funds based on recommendations from his nuncios or ambassadors around the world. Cardinal Sean O'Malley, chairman of the foundation's board of trustees, praised the foundation's stewards, stating that in a society where the gap between rich and poor continues to grow, they recognize their responsibility to prioritize the needs of the poor and vulnerable. "These grants, scholarships, and charitable initiatives are our organization's gift to the Catholic Church," the foundation's executive director, David Savage, stated. In the past year alone, the foundation has successfully supported 118 projects in over 60 countries and announced in April that it would distribute nearly $10 million in 2024. Among the beneficiaries include efforts at providing for basic needs such as access to clean water, constructing schools and renovating classrooms, and translating church teachings for evangelization. One scholarship recipient, Sister Anna Kalponami of India, is quoted in the release stating that her studies in Rome are aiding her efforts to help guide young people toward healthy use of social media. "Today, the influence of social media is growing among youth and children. My vision is to help young people become literate and responsible social media users while preserving their personal and social values," she said, thanking the Papal Foundation for its support. During an audience with Pope Francis in April, the Holy Father commended the foundation for enhancing the integral development of so many, including the poor, refugees, immigrants, and nowadays the increasingly large number of those affected by war and violence. Through these various worthy initiatives, Francis addressed the group, you continue to help the successors of Peter to build up many local churches and care for large numbers of the less fortunate, thus fulfilling the mandates entrusted to the apostle by our Lord. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on December 10, written by Belen Buckley. Indigenous leaders bring first case under Texas COVID-19 era religious liberty measure. For Gary Perez and Matilda Torres, like their ancestors before them, the River Bend in Breckenridge Park in South Texas is more than the oak trees along the riverbank, the slow-moving water, and the stars arrayed above at night. It is a sacred place, where the resident cormorants, they believe, take their prayers to the heavens. That is why, when the city of San Antonio decided to remove 69 of 83 trees and prevent bird nesting in the River Bend to allow the remodeling of a wall, Perez and Torres, ceremonial leaders of the Lipan Apache Native American Church, sued to protect it on religious grounds. Last week, the Texas Supreme Court heard their lawsuit challenging the city's actions under a state constitutional amendment approved by Texas voters in 2021 to deal with restrictions on religious services imposed by local officials during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Religious Services Amendment to the Texas Constitution says that the state or a political subdivision of the state may not enact, adopt, or issue a statute, order, proclamation, decision, or rule that prohibits or limits religious services. John Grail, an attorney and a professor at the University of Texas Law School's Law and Religion Clinic, represents Perez and Torres in Perez versus the City of San Antonio. He noted that Perez and Torres are the first claimants to bring a suit under the Religious Services Amendment, giving the court's decision in the case significant weight as a precedent. If 20 years down the road, there's some emergency and cities start putting in new orders that would affect religious services, this case will determine how that amendment gets applied to the future, Grail told RNS. Perez and Torres perform their ceremonies at a part of the park known as Lambert Beach, they explained, because of their people's ancestral connection to the land. They consider the waters, birds, trees, and constellations above a sacred ecology and a tenet of the Native American Church. They believe that the San Antonio River Bend is central to their creation story, which combines indigenous and Christian traditions. Imagine removing the Old Testament and trying to surmise what happened within the New Testament, Perez said. By removing the trees and the birds and destroying the spiritual ecology, there's no reference back to the Old Testament. There's no hope. The two appellants' brief provided evidence that for thousands of years, indigenous people have worshipped at this river bend, based on hieroglyphics found elsewhere in Texas. The brief argues that worship cannot be done elsewhere because the specific attributes to the place are crucial to the ceremony. If the trees are obstructed, if the birds are removed, Perez and Torres' ability to worship would be gone forever. The city of San Antonio has chosen a construction design that will remove all but 14 of the 83 trees at the bend without any consideration of the plaintiff's religious exercise, Grail said, before the Texas Supreme Court on December 4. A spokesperson for the city of San Antonio told RNS that the city's current plan includes a reduction in the number of trees planned for removal from 105 trees to 77 trees for phase 1 and 2 of the project. 40 trees will be relocated rather than removed altogether, and approximately 270 trees will be planted on site. At the hearing, Texas Deputy Solicitor General William Cole argued that the amendment was not a Swiss Army knife of religious liberty, and that the amendment's scope is designed to protect the right to gather. Hiram Sasser, Executive Senior Counsel for First Liberty Institute, a religious liberty advocacy group that submitted an amicus brief to the court, told RNS he was dissatisfied with the arguments from the state last week. "I was shocked that Deputy Solicitor General Cole said that Article 1, Section 6A, does not prohibit the government from banning singing in churches, especially after the Texas legislature fought so hard to give that freedom to churches after COVID shutdowns by tyrant local officials. I hope Attorney General Ken Paxton corrects the record and deals with this problem," said Sasser. Now, an article from RNS that was published on December 5 and written by Bob Smetana. How an atheist hoaxer got Christian nationalists to publish Karl Marx. An atheist writer and critical race theory critic who made his name submitting fake articles for publication in progressive academic journals and later attacking liberal evangelicals has a new target: conservative Christian nationalist. James Lindsay, who describes himself as a professional troublemaker, rewrote parts of the Communist Manifesto, adding some critiques of the liberal establishment, and then sent it off to the American Reformer, an online magazine that seeks to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day. The essay, published with a fake byline of Marcus Carlson, was published in mid-November and begins with a lead that mimics the work of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. "A rising spirit is haunting America, the spirit of a true Christian right," the essay begins, reminiscent of the opening lines of the Communist Manifesto, which reads, "A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism." The idea, Lindsay explained, was to embarrass what he described as woke right conservatives by getting them to publish the works of actual communists. They published Karl Marx's definitive communist work, dressed up to resemble their own pompous, self-pitying drivel, when it was submitted from a completely unknown author with no internet footprint whatsoever, bearing the name Marcus Carlson, Lindsay wrote in Revealing His Hoax, an announcement that coincided with the magazine's Giving Tuesday campaign. The founder of American Reformer seemed to take the hoax in stride. "Well, you have to hand it to James Lindsay. He got us," Josh Abatoy, co-founder of American Reformer, wrote on X, referring to Lindsay's hoax. The publication's editors, who did not respond to a request for a comment, added Lindsay's byline to the story, but did not retract it. However, in an editor's note, they wrote they'd be beefing up their editorial screening and noted Lindsay's lack of faith. The following article was written by James Lindsay, who, as an avowed atheist, is not eligible for publication in American Reformer, the editors wrote. The Karl Marx hoax is the latest twist in the story of Lindsay, a former massage therapist with a PhD in mathematics, who reinvented himself as an internet gadfly and self-proclaimed enemy of woke Americans, and an occasional ally of conservative Christians. Lindsay first came to fame in 2018 when he and a pair of co-authors submitted a series of papers to what they called grievance studies, American academic journals, including one paper about fat bodybuilding and another about sex at dog parks. Some of the journals published the papers, which included fake research and, in one instance, a similar strategy of updated passages of Hitler's Mein Kampf with buzzy academic phrases. Launching Lindsay into a career in mocking so-called woke liberals and critical race theory, he later teamed up with some conservative Southern Baptists who claimed their denomination had become too liberal, especially making videos about the woke invasion with Michael O'Fallon and activists who also organized cruises for Calvinist Christian nationalists. In 2023, conservative activist Charles Kirk interviewed Lindsay at a Turning Point USA event for pastors, claiming he traveled the country with the atheist activist, trying to convince Christians to fight liberals. Lindsay, who did not respond to a request for an interview, has now turned against what he calls the woke right, which he described on his podcast as conservatives using woke methods to promote conservative values. The term woke was popularized during the protests that following the death of George Floyd as a way of saying that people were aware of systemic racism. That led to a conservative backlash, including some evangelical groups who objected to any mention of social justice in religious circles. By 2022, some conservatives had begun to turn the phrase on their own, accusing others in their ranks of being divisive extremists who seek out conflict. If the first words out of their mouth, for instance, are establishment and globalist, you can rest assured they are not very thoughtful, and they are probably about to lie to you, U.S. Representative Dan Crenshaw, a Republican from Texas, told the Texas Tribune in 2022. I'm just sick of it because it's manufactured division. Neil Shenvey, a popular blogger and critic of critical race theory, labeled Christian nationalists such as Stephen Wolfe, author of The Case for Christian Nationalism, as part of the woke right for promoting the idea that conservative Christians, especially white Christians, are being oppressed by liberals. Lindsay has taken up the fight, putting him at odds with the American Reformer and groups like it. Stephen Wolfe has also been among his targets, as the former Trump administration staffer turned Southern Baptist critic William Wolfe, Gab founder Andrew Torba, Candace Owen, Tucker Carlson, and Joel Webben, a Texas pastor known for his anti-Semitic takes, claims of anti-white discrimination, and his hopes to ban women from voting. The American Reformer hoax set off a social media feud between Lindsay's allies and the supporters of those he criticized, with Lindsay's post on X about the matter receiving 1.9 million views and 666 comments as of December 5. While the American Reformer's editors were fooled by the hoax, some of its readers were not. Within days of the article's publication, readers noticed something was off and suspected plagiarism. So, as an old commercial would go, is the above article real or is it Memorex? Wrote a reader in the comments section. Our last article is an opinion piece that was published in the Christian Century in November 2024, written by Julian DeShazer, who is a senior minister of University Church in Chicago. He's also an Emmy-winning hip-hop artist who performs under the name J Quest. Why Church Marketing Won't Work with Gen Z. Equity requires people with power giving some of it up. What if we apply this principle to young adult ministry? Occasionally, a church will ask me to come help them with what I will call their youth problem. They are aging rapidly, or at the pace we all age, I guess. They struggle to attract young people, and they have a lot of passion for younger generations, but not a lot of skill. To their credit, they want to do the right thing, and I believe for the right reason. But their sense of how to make this happen in a meaningful way remains underdeveloped. And so they call me the rapping pastor because I'm good at this sort of thing, and because when we have a problem we don't believe we can handle on our own, we call consultants and plumbers and electricians and people who understand the hippity-hoppity generation. Smart. I always ask one question as part of my preliminary discernment. It isn't, why aren't they coming, or where are they going instead? I'll tell you what it is in a moment, or go to the end to read it now. But as someone who studied youth ministry origins from Don Bosco in 19th century Italy to the mall models that many megachurches now employ and that smaller churches cannot afford to employ, making them feel like failures, I know that the fumbling around we are experiencing with the youth is not about a lack of fun stuff to do. It is more centrally about a lack of relationship, a lack of desire to be in relationship, and an inability to treat youth as our equals, or as better than us, as Jesus suggests in Mark chapter 10, verses 13 to 16. In other words, it is not a marketing problem, even though many ministries treat it as such and spend a lot of energy and resources on the fringes of cool and relevant. It's an equity issue. Equity is one of those words that has gained traction in the public lexicon without generally being used correctly. The word points to how people's lives can be improved by having the same access to resources, to the sort of basic fairness that can mean the unequal distribution of resources to people on different journeys through the same system. That's why equity is different from equality. That's hard work, but in popular usage, it's been boiled down to mean something like diversity or inclusion, which doesn't say much and is probably the reason so many corporate DEI initiatives have stalled. What a bank typically means by equity initiatives is that they want to step up shop in a black neighborhood, hire black employees so it doesn't feel weird, and create a new pipeline of black customers. But when those new customers don't have the same access to loans or have to pay more to take them out, then we understand that equity really meant urban marketing. Churches operate the same way. We want more of a certain type of people because it feels connected to our sense of faithfulness. So we'll work hard to show them there's a place for them here. But when they come through the door, they are expected to do all the translating and figuring out of what the heck is going on, because church liturgies can be strange and inaccessible to newcomers, with the good news that if they do the work of becoming more like us, then they will be fully welcomed. Sounds like marketing to me. Equity, on the other hand, is less concerned with getting them in the door than with what happens to create a sense of safety and fairness once they arrive. Because a room half full of black people, or a quarter full, what are you dreaming over there, is only impressive if they get to experience their ethnicity and its idiosyncrasies in the same way most white people get to, as a norm, as simply the way things are, without much effort at all. Many youth ministries have trouble getting young people through the door, a marketing problem. But what's more important is what we do once they arrive, an equity problem. Because if we need for them to act as adults, then we really haven't done anything besides create a space for them to be more like us. And if they have to do all the work to get comfortable inside of our spaces, that's not equity either. Equity is about the people with the power giving up some so it can be shared better. We often think equity is about giving them the space to do the work, when it's really us who should be doing the work, not them. And while criticism of places like Harley-Davidson and Ford Motor Company for retreating from corporate DEI practices is well-placed, many of our churches aren't doing much better. We haven't stopped marketing, but perhaps we have stopped interrogating our systems to ensure that the people we want to come will feel safe and honored there and not have to do all the work. Think of how difficult it would be to do a hip-hop-themed worship next Sunday, or how puzzling it would seem to sing Lift Every Voice and Sing in a month not named February, and you are closer to understanding how far we are from this thing called equity, where everyone truly has an equal opportunity. It's easier to simply focus on marketing. That's what the corporations do at every festival and parade, as a way of reminding you that they'd like your business too. But we are the church, and it's our business to create the beloved community, where everyone feels whole and dignified, and humanity flourishes in the sight of God. And that everyone means we need to be in community with people that look, think, and live differently than we do. Most of our spaces have taken that up as a marketing problem. Almost assuredly, it is something much deeper. What question do I ask when I'm deciding whether I want to try to help with the church's youth problem? I ask, what are you going to do once I leave? We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll listen again next time. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.